He was the rebel the world couldn't tame, the prophet they couldn't package, the man who sang not for charts, but for change. This is not the Bob Marley story. This is the other voice, the one they tried to silence. From the hills of Westmoreland to the halls of revolution, from bullets to prophecy, Peter Tosh never bowed. He burned. This is his truth. Uncut, unapologetic, undeniable. This is Peter Tosh, voice of the fire, the untold story. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Peter Tosh, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, Babylon System and Betrayal. There are betrayals that wound the body, and then there are those that sear the soul. For Peter Tosh, the split from the Wailers was not simply the end of a musical partnership. It was the unraveling of a brotherhood, a revelation that even among the righteous, Babylon's poison could seep in undetected. The record industry, with its tailored suits and hollow smiles, had done what poverty, racism, and police beatings could not. It had driven a wedge between warriors of the same cause. But this chapter of Peter's life was not only about betrayal. It was about awakening, about seeing the machine not just for what it was, but for how deep its roots ran. It was about realizing that Babylon didn't just wear a uniform or sit in a government office. Sometimes it wore a smile. Sometimes it sat beside you in the studio. And sometimes it played the guitar next to you on stage. By 1974, the cracks in the Wailers had become fault lines. The chemistry that once forged powerful harmonies had curdled into philosophical dissonance. Bob was moving forward, carried on a wave of global adoration, guided by Island Records' Chris Blackwell, and softened by production decisions aimed at crossing over to white audiences. Peter saw it with brutal clarity. The sound was cleaner, the image polished, the lyrics poetic, but no longer venomous. The fire, he thought, was being wrapped in silk. Peter didn't hate Bob. On the contrary, he loved him like a brother. But love, in its purest form, tells the truth. And the truth was, Peter no longer saw a place for himself in a group that was becoming increasingly diplomatic, increasingly silent about the harshest realities of ghetto life. The same Bob who once sang Simmer Down, beside him now sang songs of peace to the same system that beat and jailed them. To Peter, the revolution could not come wrapped in lullabies. Chris Blackwell had made it clear. Bob was to be the face, the voice, the chosen one, the messiah of reggae. And Peter? Peter was too volatile, too militant, too black, too proud, too loud, too honest. Executives didn't want to market someone who called out racism without metaphor, who named names, who threatened the political status quo with each line. Blackwell, himself a white Jamaican aristocrat, couldn't mold Peter into something profitable. And Peter, never one to be molded, refused to play the part. The betrayal wasn't just in the studio. It was in the silence. The silence when contracts were signed without consultation. The silence when Island Records quietly reshaped the Wailers into Bob Marley and the Wailers. The silence when the revolution was being curated for white ears. And worst of all, it was in the smiles. The polite, calculated smiles that masked decisions made in boardrooms far removed from Trench Town. Peter felt it like a gut punch. They had built something sacred together. They had bled together. Slept on studio floors. Gone hungry. Chanted down Babylon from the same microphone. And now, it was politics. Branding. Optics. The machine was hungry, and it had chosen its prophet. The others were no longer needed. Peter walked. But he didn't walk away. He walked into something. Something larger, something heavier. A purpose that no record deal could contain. A mission no manager could control. The break from the Wailers was the beginning of Peter Tosh's true emergence. As a solo prophet of fury, uncompromising, unflinching, and unrelenting. In interviews, he didn't mince words. "I am the equal rights and justice man," he declared. "I don't want peace. I want justice." He spoke not like a musician, but like a revolutionary disguised as one. And his solo work reflected that shift instantly. Babylon, once a biblical metaphor, became a living, breathing enemy in Peter's songs. It was the system that criminalized ganja while importing cocaine. It was the police force that brutalized Rastafarians and protected politicians. It was the international banking structure, the IMF, the colonial legacy, and the local traders who upheld it. To Peter, Babylon wasn't abstract. It had names, addresses, and uniforms, and he would name them all. He began writing with venomous clarity. Lyrics that didn't flirt with politics, they married it. In tracks like Downpresser Man, he flipped the Christian narrative on its head, turning the language of judgment back on the oppressors. He sang not to comfort, but to confront. His words were no longer requests, they were warnings. But with clarity came consequence. Peter was now seen as dangerous. Not just by the government, but by the industry, by foreign diplomats, by Jamaican power brokers who saw his growing influence and feared it. He was often shadowed by police, harassed during interviews, and blacklisted from major local events. His home was raided without cause. His friends were interrogated. Producers were pressured to drop him. He was marked, not for death, but for silencing. And yet, he didn't stop. Instead, he pushed harder. When no one would play his songs, he performed in the streets. When radio stations refused to spin his records, he printed them independently. He started holding reasoning sessions with youth, sharing knowledge, challenging narratives, urging them to think, not just sing along. His concerts weren't shows, they were political rallies wrapped in rhythm. He didn't dress for the camera. He wore military fatigues. He smoked ganja openly, not just as a rite, but as a ritual of rebellion. Some said he was paranoid. Others said he was too angry, too wild. But those who truly listened, who leaned into the words instead of recoiling from the fire, understood. Peter wasn't mad. He was awake. And that, more than anything else, terrified Babylon. Even among his peers, some distanced themselves. Promoters feared booking him. Fellow artists, under pressure from labels or governments, avoided aligning too closely. He became a lone voice in a world of compromise. And yet, he thrived in that isolation. It gave him clarity. It stripped away pretense. It forced him to rely on nothing but truth. And that truth burned hotter than ever. By the mid-70s, Peter Tosh wasn't just a musician. He was a threat. He had no army, but his guitar was a weapon. He had no political office, but his voice moved crowds. He had no international machine behind him, but he had the one thing Babylon feared most: conviction. He had walked through the fire of betrayal and emerged not weakened, but weaponized. And though he bore the scars of the system's rejection, he wore them like medals. Because Peter knew something most feared to admit. Babylon does not fall because of silence. It falls because someone finally stands up and speaks, clearly, loudly, and without apology. Chapter 6, Legalize It, The Solo Rebirth. When the smoke finally cleared from the shattered bond of the Wailers, Peter Tosh stood alone, but not broken. He wasn't stepping into a spotlight. He was stepping into a battlefield. With no label to protect him, no carefully orchestrated PR campaign to cushion his entry into the solo world, and no illusions left about the nature of the system he was confronting, Peter emerged from the wreckage like a man reborn. Not as a star, but as a soldier. Not as an entertainer, but as an executor of truth. And he came bearing a single commandment, not hidden in metaphor, not wrapped in feel-good melody, but screamed with the defiance of a prophet who'd seen too much to ever play it safe again. Legalize it. The phrase would go on to echo across continents, protest signs, courtrooms, universities, and airwaves for generations. But in 1976, it was a declaration of war. Peter Tosh's debut solo album, Legalize It, was not just a musical project. It was a manifesto, an act of civil disobedience in vinyl form, a defiant slap to the face of the Jamaican government, the global war on drugs, and every institution that sought to criminalize his culture, his religion, and his very existence. It was the voice of every Rasta harassed for growing a sacred plant, every youth locked up for a spliff, every elder whose prayers rose with ganja smoke to the heavens and were met not with reverence, but with police brutality. Peter was no longer interested in entertaining the world. He was interested in challenging it. The album was recorded with a mixture of rage and clarity. From the moment the first track begins, Peter's voice doesn't just sing, it commands. There is no hesitation in his delivery, no ambiguity in his message. When he says legalize it, and I will advertise it, he is not courting a trend. He is daring the world to acknowledge the lie it's been telling. The song itself was more than a stoner anthem. It was deeply rooted in spirituality, sovereignty, and science. For Peter, ganja wasn't recreation, it was ritual. A plant given by Jah, referenced in scripture, used by prophets and healers since the beginning of time. He understood the deeper hypocrisy. Tobacco killed millions. Alcohol destroyed families. But it was ganja, the sacred herb of the poor, that was criminalized. Why? Because Babylon knew the herb was a gateway, not to destruction, but to consciousness. And consciousness was dangerous. The backlash was immediate. Jamaica's Broadcasting Corporation banned the song. Government officials condemned it publicly. Police raids on Rasta communities increased. Peter, already on Babylon's radar, became its obsession. Yet every time the establishment tried to silence him, he grew louder. He didn't backtrack. He doubled down. He gave interviews unapologetically smoking a spliff, listing the medicinal, agricultural, and spiritual benefits of marijuana while challenging reporters to confront their ignorance. He wasn't afraid to go deeper either. Tracks like Why Must I Cry pulled back the curtain to reveal the emotional scars behind the militancy. In that song, Peter shows his vulnerability, his heartbreak, his loneliness, his sense of abandonment. It's a raw confession from a man who had given everything to a movement and found himself standing in the rubble. It proved that rage and sorrow are not opposites, they are brothers. And Peter carried both. But make no mistake, legalize it was still a weapon. On Exia Behar, Let Jah Be Praised, Peter proclaimed his faith with thunderous force, fusing Rastafari theology with electric instrumentation and chanting verses that struck like scripture. He wasn't just praising Jah, he was reminding Babylon that their man-made systems were feeble against divine law. Jah is my keeper, he sang, not as comfort but as warning. The album cover itself was a statement. Peter crouched in a ganja field, surrounded by towering green plants under the Jamaican sun. It was a visual middle finger to every authority figure that had tried to erase his culture, his faith, his rights. It wasn't a fantasy. It was a documented truth, boldly placed where anyone with eyes could see it. And that's the thing about Peter Tosh, he refused to hide anything. He didn't hide his anger, his hurt, his spirituality, or his politics. While other artists were told to soften, to compromise, to blend into the international market, Peter sharpened every edge. He called out imperialism, racism, and religious hypocrisy in every interview. You can't be half free, he would say. You either is or you isn't. And I isn't about to beg for my rights like a dog. I demand them like a lion. The international press didn't know what to make of him. In Europe, he was compared to Malcolm X. In America, he was often dismissed as too radical, even as his music drew underground acclaim. But what they couldn't deny was the power of his presence. Every word felt urgent. Every performance like a sermon delivered at gunpoint. And in Jamaica, despite the bans and threats, the streets heard him. The ghetto youths, the Rasta elders, the herbalists, the freedom fighters, they heard him. And they followed. Peter's home became a place of pilgrimage. Young musicians sought his advice. Political radicals sought his approval. He was becoming more than a reggae artist. He was becoming a leader. But leadership came at a cost. While Legalize It gained international attention, it also attracted scrutiny. Peter was now watched more closely than ever. His phone was tapped. His movements tracked. Police showed up unannounced. He was beaten during one arrest, his skull fractured. No charges filed. No apology given. He bore the injuries publicly, refusing to hide what Babylon had done. Still, he rose. He toured the album across Europe and Africa, where crowds erupted in revolutionary chants. In Amsterdam, he was hailed as a prophet. In Ghana, he was treated like royalty. Everywhere he went, he brought his message: free the herb, free the people, burn down the lies. And unlike many artists who adjusted their message depending on the audience, Peter never wavered. Whether he was speaking to dreadlocked youth in a trench or white intellectuals at a university, he told the same truth. He was no longer just reacting to oppression, he was attacking it. In the years following Legalize It, Peter would continue to refine this attack. He would amplify his demands for reparations, his disdain for the church's hypocrisy, his allegiance to Africa. But Legalize It was the spark. The moment he turned his pain into prophecy, his voice into weaponry. He had walked through fire and emerged with a message burned into his bones. Don't beg Babylon for mercy. Expose them. Mock them. Resist them. And never stop chanting down the lies until justice is not just a dream, but a daily reality. Chapter 7, Equal Rights, Unequal World. Peter Tosh had already fired his opening shot with Legalize It, but that was only the prelude. If Legalize It was a rebel's declaration, Equal Rights was a holy war, an indictment, a roar, a demand carved into melody with the precision of a prophet's blade. It was not crafted for entertainment, nor was it packaged for mass consumption. It was not meant to soothe, it was meant to unsettle. And it did, because in 1977, equal rights didn't just arrive, it erupted. There was nothing abstract or diplomatic about the album's title. Equal rights. Not someday. Not ideally. Now. For all. Without apology. Peter didn't want pity. He didn't want charity. He wanted what was owed. And if it wasn't given freely, then it had to be taken, through voice, through fire, through vibration. This wasn't a call for unity painted in pastel. This was revolution in blood-red ink, scrawled across Babylon's trembling white walls. The opening track, Get Up, Stand Up, co-written with Bob Marley before their split, was already a clarion call across oppressed communities worldwide. But here, Peter reclaimed it, recontextualized it, sang it like a final warning to those in power. He wasn't pleading with the masses, he was ordering them to awaken. And when he bellowed, "Don't give up the fight," it wasn't a hook, it was a commandment. But the true spiritual engine of the album, the track that still echoes in classrooms, protests, and prison cells to this day, was Equal Rights. The lyrics were unflinching. Everyone is crying out for peace. None is crying out for justice. Peter didn't just highlight the imbalance, he held it up like a mirror. Because peace without justice was illusion. It was silence in place of freedom. And he wasn't going to sing lullabies while his people were still being beaten, jailed, and buried beneath systems designed to erase them. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice. With those lines, he forever changed the language of protest music. He didn't ask. He demanded. And he did it with eyes wide open, knowing full well the consequences. Because when you name the devil in public, the devil takes notice. Peter knew that what he was creating wasn't just music, it was a weapon. Each track was a sermon sharpened by suffering, each chorus a shout from the bottom of society's well. He layered militant reggae rhythms with messages that cut across oceans and empires. The arrangements were tighter, the instrumentation more urgent, the energy relentless. On Downpressor Man, he flipped traditional gospel on its head, turning the concept of the oppressor into the damned. "You're gonna run to the rock, rock won't hide you," he sang, echoing Revelation. But in Peter's version, the victim didn't kneel, they stood. They hunted Downpressor through every city, every system, every sanctuary, until justice was served. Stepping Razor was more than bravado. It was autobiographical. Peter declared himself a weapon. "I'm like a stepping razor, don't you watch my size, I'm dangerous." It wasn't just about swagger, it was a warning to those who underestimated him. He may have been thin, soft-spoken at times, but his words, his mind, his conviction? Sharp enough to slice through governments. There was also African, a track that reasserted the truth the world had tried to erase from millions of black men and women. "You are not what they told you. You are not an asterisk, or a minority, or a problem. You are African. Asterisk not just in skin, but in origin. In dignity. In birthright." Peter knew that reconnection to Africa was essential, not as a tourism fantasy, but as a return to power. And that theme of identity, raw, unfiltered, proud, ran through every note of the album. He rejected colonial lies, European religious doctrine, capitalist systems, and any false narrative that told black people they were less than divine. He wasn't asking the world to see his humanity. He declared it. The global response was complicated. Europe, particularly parts of France, Germany, and the Netherlands, embraced Peter with reverence. In those countries, where radical intellectualism and anti-imperialism had long roots, equal rights was seen as both art and activism. Crowds flooded his shows, chanting his lyrics like scripture. In Amsterdam, students held his image beside that of Che Guevara and Nelson Mandela. In Ghana and Nigeria, his face was painted on walls. In Tanzania, equal rights was blasted from village radios during political rallies. But in Jamaica and the United States, the system pressed back. The album's growing popularity made Peter even more dangerous. His words weren't metaphors. They were blueprints for uprising. His face was now on FBI watch lists. His visa approvals were delayed. Jamaican authorities accused him of inciting unrest. Surveillance increased. Police raids on his home became routine. He was labeled a dissident, a troublemaker, a security threat. But he wasn't fazed. "They fear what they cannot control," he said. "And they can't control the truth." Behind the scenes, the price was mounting. Concerts were mysteriously canceled. Funding for tours dried up. Radio stations were warned. Sponsors pulled support. Even fellow artists began to distance themselves. And yet, Peter stood taller. He didn't just survive the pressure. He thrived in it. Because unlike so many others, he had nothing to lose. He had already lost comfort, security, mainstream approval. What remained was freedom. And that freedom made him unstoppable. On stage, he became more than a performer. He was a preacher with a guitar. A revolutionary with dreadlocks. A living, breathing confrontation of everything the West had tried to silence. At shows, he would pause mid-song and speak for 10, sometimes 15 minutes, about apartheid, about police killings, about the need for youth to read, to resist, to organize. He would call out presidents, pastors, and priests by name. And the crowd? They didn't cheer, they rose. His concerts felt like battle plans. Equal rights did more than entertain. It inspired. It educated. It provoked. But it also isolated. Peter was becoming an island in the reggae world. Bob Marley, while still his brother in the struggle, was now embraced globally, seen as the symbol of reggae's universal appeal. Bob was the bridge between cultures. Peter was the fire that burned them down. And yet, Peter never once asked for Bob's platform. He didn't want it. He didn't envy it. He rejected it. Because he knew the price of that acceptance was silence. And silence was betrayal. Not just of himself, but of the millions whose pain he carried in every verse. With equal rights, Peter Tosh didn't just make an album. He made an altar, a courtroom, a battlefield, and he stood on it alone, unchained, unafraid, and unrelenting. Chapter 8, The Mystic and the Warrior. To understand Peter Tosh is to confront the paradox. How could one man embody both blistering rage and spiritual serenity? How could the same voice that thundered for justice also whisper sacred praises to Jah? How could a man who called for Babylon's destruction fall to his knees before the Lion of Judah? This wasn't contradiction. It was balance. Because Peter wasn't just a revolutionary. He was a mystic. A seer. A man whose faith burned just as brightly as his fury. And if equal rights had cemented him as a militant, what followed was a period in which Peter delved deeper into the spiritual dimensions of rebellion, where the battlefield wasn't just physical, but cosmic. This was the era where the firebrand became the philosopher, where his voice spoke not only to the oppressed, but to the eternal. At the heart of Peter's spiritual journey was Rastafari, not the trend, not the image, but the essence. For Peter, Rasta wasn't something he adopted. It was something that chose him. From the early days in Grange Hill to the ghetto alleys of Trench Town, he had always felt the pull toward something ancient, something sacred, something rooted in African identity and cosmic law. Unlike many who wore dreadlocks as fashion or smoked ganja as rebellion, Peter lived Rasta with frightening sincerity. He studied Haile Selassie's speeches as scripture. He internalized Marcus Garvey's prophecies as warnings. He didn't just quote the Bible, he decoded it, dissected it, reclaimed it. The Bible, he once said, is a black man's book that white men have tried to use against us. Peter believed that Jah, the Almighty, dwelt not in churches built by colonizers, but in the heart of every sufferer. He believed that Rasta was the original path, long before empires and missions and stolen gospels. And from that belief came an unshakable clarity. If God is on the side of the oppressed, then to fight oppression is not rebellion, it is obedience. But even as he deepened his walk in faith, Peter carried a storm inside him. He was not content to merely chant down Babylon with drums and incense. He wanted to dismantle it. And that need, born of generational pain, systemic injustice, and personal betrayal, sometimes made his spirit restless. He struggled with isolation, with anger, with moments of deep frustration at the world's slowness to wake up. The more enlightened he became, the more enraged he grew at the apathy around him. And yet, there were moments when the warrior rested. There were nights when Peter would sit alone on his veranda in the hills above Kingston, gazing into the mountains, reasoning with brethren under moonlight, passing the chalice as sacred incense. He'd speak of Ethiopia, not as a distant land, but as a spiritual homeland, a center of gravity for the scattered souls of the diaspora. He'd talk about Africa, not as a political concept, but as a mother calling her children home through rhythm and roots. Peter had visions, literal ones. He spoke of dreams where he walked with Haile Selassie, where he saw chains falling from the hands of children, where Babylon's towers crumbled into dust and the humble inherited the earth. He was convinced that spiritual warfare was real, that behind every corrupt politician, every false preacher, every gun aimed at a youth's back, there was a deeper force, a spiritual darkness he was called to expose. In this way, Peter's war was never just with governments. It was with principalities, with energies, with the entire matrix of mental and spiritual captivity that told black men they were nothing, that told the poor their hunger was normal, that convinced the oppressed to bow instead of rise. And so, he fused scripture with revolution. On stage, he would quote Psalms and then pivot into a blistering chant against police brutality. In interviews, he'd rebuke colonialism with the same tone one might use to rebuke demons. And when he spoke of love, it was never vague. It was radical, fierce. Love to Peter was accountability. Love meant liberation. He began to see himself not just as a singer, but as an instrument, a vessel through which Jah's message could reach the deafest of ears. And with that came a weight few could carry. He was burdened by visions, haunted by injustice, and enraged by the hypocrisy of those who wore the mask of peace while profiting off of pain. This internal war spilled into his music. In Mystic Man, Peter crafted one of his most introspective albums. It was less overtly political, but no less powerful. Here, he described himself not just in words, but in spirit. "I'm a man of the past," he said, "living in the present, walking in the future." It was more than poetic, it was prophetic. Peter saw himself as timeless, as one who carried ancient truths into a world obsessed with noise. He refused alcohol, ate it or prayed daily, read constantly. He referred to himself as the bush doctor, but not in jest. He believed in healing through nature, through roots and herbs and vibration. And yet, he also believed in spiritual warfare, believed that words had frequency, that music had the power to either enslave or free the mind. This was what separated Peter from nearly every other artist of his generation. He didn't make music to sell records. He made it to exorcise demons. The Western media struggled to box him in. He was too black for pop culture, too political for religion, too spiritual for activism, too rebellious for the reggae establishment, too righteous to be silenced. They didn't know what to do with him. And that was exactly how he liked it. Peter once said, "I'm not a politician. I'm not a superstar. I am a servant of the Almighty. And me of work fi do." That work, to him, was sacred, and it came at a cost. The same spiritual sensitivity that gave him visions also made him vulnerable. He began to sense danger everywhere, not always paranoia, but perception. He knew he was being followed, watched, targeted, and the more he stepped into his spiritual power, the more isolated he became from the very industry he helped build. Still, he pressed forward. He began organizing reasonings, intimate gatherings where youth could hear the unfiltered truth. No cameras, no managers, just Peter, a circle of dreadlock truth seekers, and the raw fire of ancient wisdom passed down through chant, herb, and scripture. He wasn't building fans. He was building disciples of consciousness. And as the world continued to sleepwalk through capitalism and corruption, Peter walked barefoot through fire. He was not perfect. He was intense, at times erratic, prone to long silences and sudden rants. But every movement, every word, every silence carried the weight of someone who saw too clearly. Someone who couldn't play the game because he had already seen the scoreboard was rigged. He was at once a walking contradiction and a living embodiment of harmony. A man who could quote Haile Selassie and curse a corrupt bishop in the same breath. A man who meditated in the bush and stood defiant before machine guns. A man who wore the robes of a priest and the armor of a general. A man who lived in the spirit and died in the struggle. Peter Tosh was not just a rebel. He was a rebel prophet. And the fire inside him would only burn hotter.